Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Business Report, our weekly podcast on the global defense and aerospace business, sponsored by Bell Helicopter, a Textron company. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. As Americans were celebrating the nation's 241st birthday, North Korea tested its longest-range ballistic missile that can reach U.S. territory, raising tensions across the region and the United States. In Hamburg, leaders of G20 nations met to talk trade and climate and trade wars. In Washington, lawmakers were on vacation last week but are now back to talk budgets, confirmations, as well as health care and tax reform. Joining us to discuss the week in Washington are Byron Callen of the independent equity research firm Capital Alpha Partners, Steve Grundman of the Atlantic Council Think Tank, and Todd Harrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies Think Tank. Guys, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Vago.
Byron, let me start with you. You know, everybody's kind of been focused on the 2018 budget, as we discussed last week. There's a little bit of a gap. The Green Book sort of ends in 2018. That's kind of an unusual situation. Talk to us a little bit about, though, on what we're starting to glean about what could be in the 2019 budget, because work on that has already started.
That's correct, Vago. I mean, I think, you know, sure, the broad outlines of the budget. We heard from the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff recently that, you know, they were looking for at least 3-5% annual growth over the upcoming FYDP. It's, as I think we mentioned, it's debatable whether they can get to that kind of growth. There's not a lot of historic precedent for it. But I think the interesting focus this summer is going to be what comes out of some of these strategic reviews that are being done at the National Security Council and at the Department of Defense. The NSC effort is being led by Nadia Shadlow, and I guess there's another parallel one going on at the DOD. They're really going to set the table for some of the decisions that will be reflected in the FY19 FYDP. And as you know, that should start to be discussed, or people are going to be focusing on this as we move through the summer and into the fall as these numbers start to come together.
And Nadia, who is a strategist and analyst and defense intellectual in her own right over at the Smith Richardson Foundation. Todd, what's your take?
Yeah, I mean, there is a big fight brewing within the administration on the FY19 budget level for defense. So DOD is coming into the position, as Byron said, basically saying they've got a mandate to rebuild the military, to grow, to execute this defense strategy that requires more resources. And so that's what they're pushing for, is growth above the FY18 requested level of something like 3-5%, and then continued growth in the years after that. OMB is coming at it with Mick Mulvaney saying, hey, I've already given you a top line for FY19. It's basically flat. You can grow with inflation, and we're going to gradually wind down the OCO funding over time. And OMB has got a mandate to balance the federal budget within 10 years. And so they've snapped a chalk line. DOD is flat in that chalk line. And if DOD wants more, well, that means they have to cut more elsewhere within the budget. And I think most people would recognize that they've probably already cut more than they would actually be able to cut in the budget. So they're going to resist any growth in defense spending pretty fiercely. So I think there's a real showdown coming on this issue.
I think 2019 force structure comes a cropper. We've been waiting. You know, the budget has not been big enough for this force structure for about 6 years now. And that really is the fundamental incoherence of the defense budget. And for the reasons that Todd has just described, that problem is not going to get better. They're going to have to come to grips with whether they can afford the force structure they have. And I don't know that they can, even at these 050 numbers above $600 billion.
You know, the force structure issue, and I want to sort of ramp this into a conversation about North Korea. Obviously, it was an active week, nothing like deciding to launch, one of the most consequential missile tests on America's 241st birthday. But I was talking to a friend of mine, and they were asking me about troop levels in Korea, and they had sort of very dated figures. They didn't realize there were only about 30,000 U.S. troops in South Korea. And that takes us to both the force structure debate, but also the North Korea debate. You know, what's the outlook for U.S. force structure? Because if you listen to each of the military services, they will basically tell you that, for example, David Goldfein, the chief of staff of the Air Force, is very honest about telling you, my biggest modernization need is a good command and control system. But, you know, frankly, if you ask me my most important thing, it's going to be, about 30,000 more airmen to fill out units that have lost force structure over the past decade as the service has sort of transferred combat Air Force's billets to analytic billets and had to trade people off. You know, first, you know, what's the outlook for personnel? And is that itch just never going to be scratched, fundamentally? And what does the North Korean missile test tell us about, is it going to in any way shape the budget? Let's start with the personnel thing first.
So this debate between capability and capacity has been going on for a couple of years. I would agree with this notion that force structure is going to continue to be in the forefront, but I also think you're going to have more discussion yet again about the cost of some of the major weapon systems and are there potential alternatives? Can you use technology to augment or maybe complement some of the major weapon systems that all three services, I should say, really the Air Force and the Navy are looking at buying right now? There's not a lot in the Army modernization pipeline. So I'm still very intrigued with that. And maybe, you know, there's this defense innovation thrust that's been undertaken by the Department of Defense. You know, will that come more into the forefront as the DoD looks to meet some of these missions, but maybe not with the high mix that they seem to be pursuing in a lot of major weapons programs?
You know, Vago, this is Todd. And in an ideal world, you would want the defense strategy review to kind of settle this question of what's the right balance between capability and capacity. I don't think it will do that this year. I think that it's going to come down saying we need more of both, which means we need significant increases in resources, but they don't have a plan within the overall Trump administration federal budget to actually provide those resources over time. And so I think we're going to continue to stumble forward for the next few years, like we have for the past few years, where the services are each saying, I need more force structure. I need more capacity. I also have a readiness crisis. Oh, and by the way, I've got all these modernization priorities that are going to give me the capabilities I need to succeed in the future. And they're going to keep asking for all of this, and they're not going to get everything that they're looking for because they're not making the trade-offs to live within a resource-constrained environment.
But it's because we've also had a very dishonest defense debate now for a very long period of time. We wanted to not address the reality of how much money there is. And so ultimately, you know, we're going through, you know, Budget Control Act and automatic measures, which we did for a very brief amount of time. I don't want to get you started, Todd, on the whole misuse of the word sequestration, rather, you know, the Budget Control Act.
But
this administration also came in saying, you know, we're going to do another Reagan revolution, even though there were a lot of people who looked at it and said, I mean, the money is just not there in order to be able to do that. Steve?
The conjunction this week of that ostensible ICBM missile test from North Korea and the ostensible fall of Mosul and nearly of Raqqa changes the dominant conversation about the national security threats facing the country in a way that's going to aggravate the problem of trying to solve the incoherence in the budget.
Explain that.
The administration came to town with counterterrorism at the forefront of its national security mind. And I think from this moment forward, at least until the next crisis, it's kind of a back to the 1990s rogue nation, regional conflict feels to me like that which will become the dominant conversation about national security. And those tend to be more force-intensive scenarios or force-intensive contingencies than counterterrorism, frankly.
Why should what North Korea did change at all the security discussion we're having? This has not been a rush to capability. It's been a steady drive to capability. Kim Jong-un has shown, you know, he has done more missile tests than his dad and grandfather combined. We got that. But one of the things that, you know, is also apparent is he's also being a good retail politician. New York Times had a great story about how he's investing in sock factories, orphanages, ski, you know, resorts, schools, markets, trying to bring as much of a market economy to a system as you can. And so that indicates somebody who's just into regime survival. And the United States, throughout the Cold War, was targeted by a nation with tens of thousands of nuclear weapons. So we know nuclear deterrence works. He can have dozens of nuclear weapons. We have thousands of them, and ours will work. So why not just sort of look at the guy and say, hey, look, here are the rules of the nuclear game. Welcome to the club. Here are the penalties of using that weapon. I mean, isn't that the whole predicate of, you know, the underlying foundation of deterrence theory?
Well, it may go into trades, Vago. I mean, I think the whole idea, you know, this used to come up with Taiwan. Are you willing to trade Taiwan for Los Angeles? And I suppose, you know, there is an interesting dilemma because so far North Korea has not been deterred by some of the missile defense investments the United States has made. I thought last week it was fascinating to see July 5th when the markets opened, the stocks in the U.S. of companies associated with the GMD program outperformed other defense stocks. So Boeing, Orbital ATK, I think Raytheon was in there as well too. They all did a little bit better. So at least as far as the market was concerned, oh, this North Korean ICBM test means means there's going to be more money put into missile defense. I took a slightly different view on that, and that is if this accelerates or pulls forward this kind of moment of truth of, you know, Trump's comments about very severe measures that could be taken, you know, that might have a very different set of outcomes for some of these iconic missile defense programs. It could have some very profound impacts on precision-guided weapons demand, on readiness, on things like that, that, you know, might be in demand if this ends in a very bad and tragic way for everybody involved.
The premise of your question, Vago, or the tone with which you asked it, was that deterrence necessarily will work with this cat the way it has worked with others in the past. And I think there is good reason to wonder if deterrence works. There's a very nice interview with the former director of the Missile Defense Agency, Patrick O'Reilly, from earlier this week, where he starts the whole interview by saying, what the great leader in North Korea is doing doesn't make sense. Right? He says several times he's not behaving logically. I don't know he realized he was undermining the premise of deterrence theory. Maybe he did, because it was interesting how frequently he said what he's doing doesn't make sense for all the reasons that you articulated, and yet there he goes.
But there is an abundance, and I appreciate the general's view, but there's also an abundance of, you know, AEI just did a great report looking at the Iranians. Everybody has this perception of crazy mullahs and ayatollahs who, you know, but if a Matt McGinnis did a, you know, great report that said, actually, they're remarkably strategic, and I think
Iran's
that there are people...
completely different case.
I understand, but there are those who look at North Korea and say the same thing. The guy is really strategic, knows where to sort of push it, and frankly, China is not going to help us solve the problem because, you know, they answer that question in during the Korean War, when the United States got very close to the Chinese border, 300,000 Chinese troops responded by almost pushing us off the peninsula. So the Chinese will not solve.
I would argue, Vaga, that actually this is rational, or I do think what he is doing is rational.
I agree. I think it's very rational.
Pursuing a nuclear weapon, there's no way that a country with a $40 billion GDP, which is frankly less than Lockheed Martin's total annual sales, is going to be able to keep pace and modernize its conventional military forces. So
let's look at this from a North Korean perspective. Is it rational or not? I tend to think it is pretty rational for them. As Byron was saying, you know, having a nuclear weapon and a long-range delivery vehicle gives them a way to deter the United States. It's not a question of whether or not we can deter them. What he's doing is he's creating a way to deter us, and that's why the U.S. is actually worried about this. And I would also add that let's look at the numbers on this launch that was, you know, over July 4th holiday. It was on a lofted trajectory. It went to an altitude of over 2,800 kilometers, and the range was actually only about 930 kilometers. Now, it's a lofted trajectory, so that means if you launched it at a lower angle, effectively, you could get a much greater distance. It's enough of a distance to hit a good part of Alaska and maybe some outer fringe islands of the Hawaiian island chain. But it is telling that for the past several long-range missile tests, the North Koreans have deliberately launched them on these lofted trajectories.
Right.
That it is obviously provocative when they do this, and they are intentionally doing it, you know, like July 4th, to poke us in the eye. But they are also at the same time showing some restraint by launching it on a lofted trajectory rather than actually launching it on a long-range trajectory that would fly over places like Japan. So, you know, there is some logic, there is some, you know, rationality behind what they're doing here. And I think that is what actually makes this a scary threat.
Our time is brief, so I want to cover two things. We've seen some trade deals, you know, got back from the Paris Air Show and talked to Eric Trappier, who is the CEO of Dassault Aviation, but he also heads the French Aerospace Association, as well as Europe's Aerospace and Defense Association. And one of the points that he had to make was, he said, look, I think it's very natural for the United States to have Buy American. And he said, and that's one of the reasons why Europe should have Buy European. Byron, this goes to the point that you made, sort of the danger of America first is that it triggers tendencies that other countries may have. We've seen the EU, as it's working through Brexit, now striking trade deals. There have been deals with the Chinese. Xi Jinping has been more than happy to come in there and fill that void, as has Shinzo Abe, who last week struck a trade deal with the Europeans. Is your reading tea leaves? Are there changes in tea leaves? Because if you listen to the president's Warsaw speech, it's much more along the lines of the, you know, right, there are always this debate about which pole the president is shifting between. It seemed very much his sort of classical clash of civilizations, radical Islamic terrorism is there's an existential threat. You know, are we able to read anything into this about what it means for this highly globalized defense and aerospace industry?
I'll bring it down to a more prosaic level, which is this whole Section 232 investigation that's going on steel and aluminum, because I think that's, you know, probably one of the more tangible immediate impacts. And I tend to think, look, yes, there's a potential for much sharper trade tensions. I think it's somewhat encouraging that the imminent decision on Section 232 continues to be pushed out. It's going to be interesting to see, you know, what happens in the wake of the G20 meetings this past weekend in Hamburg, you know, if that further tempers some of the administration's desire to protect the U.S. steel and aluminum industries. On the steel side, I think Steve's colleague at Atlanta Council, Jim Hasek, in the industrialist blog that Atlanta Council has done some excellent work on the steel issue, and that it's really shouldn't be a national security issue for the United States. Aluminum, my understanding is there are some more subtle implications for things like littoral combat ship program, but maybe that's something we could take up at a later date.
All those implications, by the way, or the net effect of them is to raise prices.
Yep.
In this administration's whole mania about trade, it continues to surprise me how we never talk about that, how what the net effect of these things in the civilian economy as well as the defense economy is to, all other things being equal, raise prices. When that comes to bite, if it does, you know, comma, on the other hand, Jim's work, which is terrific, also points out how minuscule imported steel and aluminum are in defense products. So it probably won't come to bite, but the further irony of that just does recur in my mind every time we get a bout of America first.
Well, look, I mean, I can tell you that when possible, I try to buy, you know, American-made products, you know, whether it's tools or anything else, and there is a very noticeable price difference. And sometimes, you know, even family members of mine are like, good Lord, man, you could have bought this clamp for, you know, $1.50 instead of $5.50. And I'll justify and say, well, I mean, you know, the American clamp was, you know, made in the United States and provided jobs in the United States. On the other hand, from a functional standpoint, you know, it's sometimes not all that much better. Todd, anything you want to add to this before we shift to appointments the week ahead in the Defense Innovation Board?
No, I think you guys said it all.
Let's go to appointments. It looks like the administration is starting to fill up. The Navy Secretary Richard nominee is going to be going up in front of the Senate next week. You know, we had Ellen Lord. We talked about her last week as the nominee for acquisition technology and logistics. Let's just talk more generally about the week ahead and what you guys are going to be looking at.
Well, yeah, you're right, Vaga. The confirmation hearings this week, I think, are going to be, you know, another touchstone. Although, frankly, there's not a lot that usually comes out of those other than, you know, frankly, how will a chairman of that committee, you know, position? What kind of messages is he trying to send? I think a lot of the people who go before these are very well coached in what to say and not say. You mentioned the Defense Innovation Board. They're doing a public meeting at the DIUX office in Mountain View. I think that's Wednesday. So it's going to be interesting. You know, they picked up on this theme of big data in the Department of Defense. And because the meeting is being held in Silicon Valley and it's public, I think it's just going to be interesting to see, well, who weighs in? What will Silicon Valley potentially be saying about DIUX, the Department of Defense, and big data in general?
Todd?
Yeah, the thing that has struck me, you know, over the past couple of weeks is that as unusual as this administration and this transition has been, I think things are starting to normalize a bit. As you point out, they are filling up these positions, albeit it is slow compared to previous transitions. But people are getting into the administration jobs. They're filling out the ranks. And I think Washington is starting to adjust to this new normal. And so I think that, you know, the wheels are going to be turning. It's at a different rate and in a different direction than they have been in the past, but I think things are starting to normalize with the administration. And that is, I wasn't expecting that.
Apropos of this conversation, Vago, I hope and expect you would allow an applause for Bob Work, the current Deputy Secretary of Defense, but who I think will be leaving office either at the end of this week or soon, who's been quite a bipartisan trooper, it must be said. Substantively, the aspect of his departure that will be worth keeping an eye on is whether all these remnants of the Defense Innovation Initiative actually continue beyond his tenure in office. It's been an interesting and somewhat surprising aspect of the new administration's plans that they have essentially let the Defense Innovation Initiative, although I guess they don't use the words third offset, or I haven't heard them use those words. Certainly the Innovation Board, DIUX, carries on. I have wondered if that wasn't Bob Work's hand at play and whether the administration will choose to turn its back or turn the page on that particular very Obama administration cachet once Bob has left office. But kudos to Bob Work, a great servant of rational defense, if I may say it.
Hear, hear. Yeah,
absolutely. I think there's universal acclaim that Bob certainly has made a mark, and as did Ash Carter. You know, I mean, kudos to Ash for having started and set and trained things like Strategic Capabilities Office and always working on some very, very innovative things that in combination with Bob and the third offset have been, are going to be very welcome. Guys, thanks very much for spending so much time with us, and we'll be talking to you from the UK next week because we're going to be at the Royal International Air Tattoo. Thanks very much, guys. And joining us as he does every week is Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Ron, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Franco. Glad to be here.
At the end of last week and over the weekend was the G20 summit. We talked about this a little bit in the first part of the show, where the administration is considering tariffs on steel as well as on aluminum. And the Europeans had a very strong reaction to that. I mean, they basically looked at that as fighting words, given that Europe is the world's, you know, second, it's right after China in terms of a major steel producer. You know, what are the implications? I mean, are folks on markets or the folks that you're talking to concerned about what the implications of a trade war would be, which is exactly what the Europeans are threatening if the administration does go in that direction?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question, Vago. It hasn't really percolated up that much in defense and commercial aerospace investors' minds yet. I mean, most certainly, I think it will, right? If you look across, you know, a lot of the important programs in both the commercial and defense industrial base, things like the Lakota program, the CFM56, the LEAP program, the F-18, just to name a few, there's trade that goes both directions, right? But so far, it hasn't really percolated up all that much. I would imagine, I don't talk to them all that much, but investors in materials such as the metals will probably see it as positive, you know, because the metal sector itself has been beaten down pretty hard, particularly by the Chinese. I don't want to use the word dumping, but providing lower cost steel onto the market. And that's had a pretty profound impact on the steel producers in the U.S.
And that's one of the reasons why the administration is interested, right? I mean, they're crying. The cry is that this is a national security imperative by the United States.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's clearly, right? I mean, I don't have like a pipe into the Trump administration, but it's hard to see this as really a blow against Europe. It seems like this is more positioning against China. And I think, I mean, not to talk out of line here, but maybe this is even some sort of way to position politics around North Korea, or who knows exactly what. But, you know, hopefully the Europeans don't read it as a threat to them, because it's hard to see that that's what they're trying to do.
You mentioned North Korea. North Korea's obviously been in the news. A lot of debate here on what the next steps are. Everybody, you know, whether in Washington or London or anywhere else, is pointing to a diplomatic solution to this. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff that could meaningfully shape markets, right? You've got the North Korea stuff, but as well, you've got, you know, interest rates are going up. September and October are going to be very, very important months from a central banking perspective. You've got, you know, weird market trends that are going on. Inflation's really weak, but there's a very strong jobs market, you know, and there's still a lot of calm on the volatility index, which also makes it kind of unusual, as we were talking just before we started taping. Talk to us a little bit about how the markets are looking at all of these themes, especially when it comes to defense and aerospace.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? So on the North Korean situation, it seems like one of the easiest paths to go down is just build some more missile defense, I mean, particularly if you're, you know, in the region or impacted by that. So I think one of the initial interpretations you're going to see from investors, and I think you started to see it late last week, even though it was a thinly traded week because folks were out for the 4th of July holiday, is they're looking at producers of missile defense equipment. And I wouldn't be surprised if you see a bit of a bid up in those stocks. So, you know, names like, you know, Raytheon come to mind, Lockheed, to name a few. What you mentioned about the market is particularly interesting right now. You know, the Fed has signaled clearly, right, they want to raise rates again, probably at their next meeting, if not that one, and the one after that. So you've got, you know, the specter of rates going up. The Fed has also signaled that they want to start reversing their balance sheet, shrinking it. You know, the Fed balance sheet right now is huge with all kinds of different forms of debt. And they want to start to get back to a more normal balance sheet. And you're sort of in this abnormal phase. And that's combined with a very bizarre environment economically, where you've got, you know, extraordinarily strong jobs, at least, you know, in recent history, extraordinarily strong. A lot of cash in the market. I mean, the Fed's been printing a lot of money, and really weak inflation. So you're starting to have investors really question, you know, fundamental models around what inflation means. When you add this all up, you get to an environment where, you know, you have a full labor market I would argue, probably frothy asset prices, central banks tightening. And like you mentioned, the VIX is really low. And when you put that all together, those have been signals in the past that we might be at a top and you could see a reset, an economic top, and you could see a recession in the not too distant future. Investors, if they really start thinking that way, and you're starting to see more of that in the financial press, the defense sector is always a natural haven for investing. So it really is an interesting setup for defense because you, on a very fundamental level with growing budgets in the U.S. and internationally, combined with the potential threat of a recession floating around, maybe not as far out as some people think, it'll probably make the defense space pretty attractive, both in the short term and medium term. You know, one of the questions I get very frequently from investors is, hey, you know, the defense stocks have just kind of gone up and to the right for a number of years now. You know, how long can that continue? And in a backdrop of growing defense budgets, plus the specter of a potential recession out there, I wouldn't be surprised to see defense stocks to continue to outperform relative to the broader market. Now, if we were to see a recession, obviously the market would go down, but defense would either go down less or maybe just stay flat. We'll see. And to be clear, I'm not calling for a recession, but this is the kind of talk we're starting to hear in both the financial press and with investors.
What are some of the big things you're looking forward to this year? It's kind of a slow time of year, but there's always something going on. What are you paying attention to, you know, focusing on particularly in this coming week?
Yeah, so a week from now, the earnings starts to kick off, right? So, you know, this coming week, you know, we're going to really kind of start to go through all our financial models and kind of ferret back what we think is going to happen to earnings for the companies. You know, just as an example, you know, Boeing's deliveries for the quarter were a little bit behind what we were looking for and other investors. And, you know, what's that mean for the quarter? And, you know, one quarter doesn't necessarily mean anything, right? Because it's a quarter and you just kind of have to average over the year. But, you know, what's going on there? You know, defense outlays have been particularly strong. You know, what's that mean for the defense guys? But I think, you know, this is the week where we batten down the hatches and really kind of scrub our models and do our homework and prepare for earnings, which starts in earnest the following week.
Ron, thanks very much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Please follow our daily video interviews with top government, military, industry, and thought leaders at Defense and Aerospace Report. That's at www.defaeroreport.com and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. And check out our extensive coverage of the Paris Air Show, sponsored by L3 Technologies and Leonardo DRS, including our interviews with Eric Trappier, the CEO of Dassault Aviation, who also heads the French aerospace industries, as well as European Aerospace and Defense Industries Associations, Chris Ferguson, America's last space shuttle commander, who now heads Boeing's Starliner spacecraft program, Bruce Klingner of the Heritage Foundation on North Korea's latest missile tests, Julie Smith of the Center for a New American Security on Russia, and our exclusive exit interview with Lieutenant General John Dog Davis, the Marine Corps' Deputy Commandant for Aviation, as he prepares to retire from 37 years in uniform. You can follow us on Twitter at Def Aero Report, that's at DefAero Report, and on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and you can follow me on Twitter at Vago Maradian. Thanks again to Bell Helicopter, a Textron company, for their generous sponsorship. Hope everyone had a wonderful Independence Day holiday, and until we're together again, have a great week.